There it happened. The place Babylon, of course, is an American air base, which is a sacrilege, a desecration of a fantastic archaeological site, which they've covered in concrete, but it's a real place. We know that this is real. In fact, on Wednesday, I actually flew over exactly the very place that this happened. I was at 40,000 feet, so I didn't see very much. But the very place, the plains of Jura outside Babylon, I was flying back from the Gulf, from the Persian Gulf on Wednesday, and I wished I could have just gone, swooped down and had a little look, but it's a real place. So these things are not stories, these are real events. And it's a mistake for us to treat them as sort of Sunday school tales. What we've got to recognise is these are real people who did real things, and we need to learn from them. So I've entitled this talk on Daniel chapter 3, Fireproof Faith. And I want to just talk about a few things. First of all, just the basic story and what it's really about in very basic terms. I want to highlight three questions about fireproof faith. Questions that immediately struck me when I read this story. How could that be? Something strange here, I don't quite understand. And then draw one main lesson. And if we have time, I want to just give you some advice on home security if we've got time towards the end. Just thought it might be useful to throw in. So the basic story, as Wendy shared with us, is this huge image of God with a dedication ceremony. And at the ceremony, everybody is required to bow down and worship the image. If they don't, they're going to be thrown into a flaming furnace. Did you ever wonder where the furnaces came from? Actually, Steve gave us the answer last week, because Nebuchadnezzar did lots of building. And he made bricks for the building. And Steve showed us a picture of a brick that had Nebuchadnezzar's name written on the brick. And of course, bricks are made in furnaces. And the furnaces were on the plain of Jura. This is the very place where he set up the image, where all these furnaces were, where they made the bricks to do all the building in Babylon. So furnaces were ready-made there. I don't know whether he had that in mind when he chose that place to set up the image. But certainly, the furnaces existed. And we found some of them. They've been dug up and they really do exist. So if you don't bow down and worship, you're going to be thrown into this fire. So, surprise, surprise, they did. Okay, that's a reasonable incentive. And then Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego didn't. And they defied the king's order. Nebuchadnezzar seems to have been on their side. He was a bit cross, but he did give them a second chance. And they still refused. And so, unfortunately, the king didn't change his mind and threw them into not just any furnace, but had it superheated, seven times hotter than it was normally used for. And then the miracle, then the amazing thing that we wouldn't have expected. You know, you would have expected, well, I don't know what you would have expected, but this thing happened. Three people go in, all tied up, and he first of all sees them walking around. Interesting, the only thing that was burned was the robes that tied them up. The ropes that tied them up. But he sees somebody else, a fourth person in the furnace, and he's absolutely amazed, well, not surprisingly. And he calls them out, and they say, no, why don't you come in here? But no, actually, they come out to where he is, and they come out completely unscathed. And it says in the Bible, lovely touch, all of the people gather around, so they actually have a look at this. Is it a ghost? Is it some sort of hallucination? And all of the officials gather around and actually see them, and recognize that they don't even smell of smoke. They're completely unharmed. And then Nebuchadnezzar praises their God and forbids anybody else to speak against their God and promotes them. Quite an amazing story. So the basic application that we're drawing from all of these studies in Daniel that Stuart shared with us a couple of weeks ago when he was talking on chapter 1 is that we are like Daniel and his friends in these first 7 or 8 chapters of the book. Because we live in a foreign culture. They were taken out or forcibly removed from their homeland, from God's promised land where they lived. And as young people, aged perhaps 16, 18, 20, somewhere around there, they were forcibly removed and taken off to be in Babylon and forced to live in this foreign culture. And we too live in a culture which is not our own culture. I don't know if anybody heard the Moral Maze on Radio 4 last night at just after 10 o'clock. It was the 500th edition of the programme. You can hear it on Radio 4's Listen Again service if you want to. But the subject they were talking about was post-religious culture and morality. How can you have morality in a culture which is post-religious? They didn't say post-Christian, but they were talking about post-religious. Very interesting discussion, and you might want to just have a listen. But people are recognising we're in a post-religious or post-Christian culture. It's no longer the majority view. And we are here as a minority, and we've got to work out how we live in this strange culture, which isn't natural to us. And in this culture, it's interesting because faith, any kind of faith, is either offensive or irrelevant. If you believe, people might say, well, that's fine for you, but of course it doesn't affect me. You know, you carry on, you can do anything you like, as long as it doesn't upset me. But if you do speak out and you're firm about what you believe and you actually dare to say so, then people take offence. Not just at Christians, of course, at basically any kind of religion. And that's the culture that we live in. So the challenge that we're trying to draw and learn from these studies in the book of Daniel is, what do we do about that? How can we stay faithful within this context where we're seen as irrelevant or offensive? Can we stay faithful to God? How can we present a challenge or a witness to that culture? How do we speak in a way which is going to be received and heard? And how does our faith not just survive but thrive? It's important that we don't get this kind of remnant mentality where we're just seen as desperately hanging on, waiting for the second coming, and if only we can get through, it'll be all right, and maybe I'll die beforehand, and that'll be a great relief. But, you know, we're supposed to be victorious. We're supposed to be uber conquerors, according to St. Paul. We're overcomers, super overcomers. And that's what we're supposed to be. How can that be true? And so what we're going to do in these studies is say, let's learn from Daniel and his friends how they remained faithful to God, how they presented a relevant challenge in the culture of Babylon, and how their faith survived and thrived. So that's what we're trying to do. Now, let me start with my questions. Three questions which struck me as I was reading through. And the first was, I wonder what the image looked like. I don't know if you wondered that, or if you just automatically assumed something. Do you think it looked like one of these? The one on the left here is the Golden Buddha of Bangkok, and it's 106 feet high. You might have noticed in when Wendy read that she said the statue was 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. It's actually a mistake. I'm sorry, if you'd like to just cross that out in your Bible. It should be 100 feet high and 10 feet wide. Because it actually says in the Bible, you don't really have to cross it out. She's getting her Bible out, she's going to do it. Because it actually says it was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. Now, of course, the cubit is the distance from your elbow to your little finger. And in fact, in Babylon, there were two types of cubit. There was a trade cubit, which most people used, and it was 18 and a half inches, which is why they translated helpfully 60 cubits is 90 feet. Based on 18 inches. I actually measured mine. Mine's only 16 and a half inches. I don't know about Neil. Neil's probably got a sort of super cubit. But actually, everyone thought that the king had a super cubit. And so when the king did any building, he didn't use the normal trade cubit. He used a royal cubit. And the royal cubit was 20 and a half inches long. It's comparing Neil to me, really. And so actually, if you work on a royal cubit, which is what he would have used, then it turns out to be 100 feet high and 10 feet wide. This is 106. This is perhaps what it might have looked like, at least that high. This one, which is Kim Il-sung, who's the father of Kim Il-jong in North Korea, that's only 65 feet high. But did you think that the image looked something like that? It was perhaps an image of Nebuchadnezzar, except that it was, the proportions are 10 to 1. It's 90 by 9, or 100 by 10, or 60 by 6. And incidentally, 60 is an important number for the Babylonians. Their whole numerical system was based on 60, and that's why we have 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour, because the Babylonian numbering system was based on 60, and why we've got 360 degrees in a circle. So 60 is important. I don't think the image did look like this, because the natural proportions of a human body are 5 to 1. 5 wide, most of us anyway, 5 wide, every 1 wide, 5 high. And you can sort of see that with this. So 1 to 10 is not the right normal proportions for a human figure. So there is another statue, or another sort of tall thing, which is 100 feet high and 10 feet wide, and you might have seen it. It's at Legoland in Copenhagen. And that's actually a 100 foot high tower, which happens to be 10 foot wide at the base. And do you think the statue looked a bit like that? I don't know. The interesting thing is we really don't know what the statue looked like, and does it matter? Maybe it was just a normal-sized statue or image which was on a huge tower, a huge sort of platform that was quite high. The important thing is that the image stood for something. And the image, in the way that it was made and the way that it was presented, represented something. First of all, it was very big. As we say, it has these sort of huge dimensions. And it would have been visible a long way away. It would have dominated the whole scenery, the whole sort of landscape. You would have seen this on the plains of Jura, so everything else was flat. And then there was this huge thing that was shining, and with gold, the sun would have reflected off it. And it was something which dominated. It was all gold. And I think that's interesting because, as Steve shared with us last week, the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, which was a prophecy about the future, foretelling the rise of five different empires, here's Steve's picture again in the corner here, had a golden head, and then a silver sort of torso, and then had a bronze loins, and had iron legs, and then iron mixed with clay in the feet. And the interpretation was, these are different kingdoms, and you, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. I think, I just wonder if Nebuchadnezzar thought about that. I'm the head of gold. Gold, that's me. Let's set up a statue which is all gold. Let's forget this statue which says there are silver and bronze and iron kingdoms to come after me. Let's just focus on me. Let's focus on my kingdom, the all gold statue. See the face you love light up with Nebuchadnezzar's all gold. I think maybe he was just saying, let's try and forget, let's put out of my mind the silver kingdom and the bronze kingdom and the iron kingdom. Let's just focus on my kingdom and my power and me. And you think about what's in front of you. I am Nebuchadnezzar, the King of Kings, the greatest king that's ever been known. Nebuchadnezzar the Great. So it was all gold. And it represented something. You'll notice whenever he talks about it, or whenever the herald talks about it, you don't just bow down in front of the image. He said to the three Hebrew leaders, he said, why aren't you worshipping my gods, or serving my gods, and bowing down to my golden image? Every time the two things are linked. There's a physical action, but it seemed to be representative of something, of submitting to the gods of Babylon. Serve my gods and bow down to the image. The two go together. And that was the challenge. Will you do that? Now, we don't have golden images that are 100 feet high in our country. Or I don't think anywhere in the world apart from the golden Buddha of Bangkok. So what does that mean for us today? What can we learn about faith? And from our basic application that we're trying to learn here about being like Daniel and his friends in our foreign culture, what can we learn? Well, there are images. There are things in our culture which dominate the landscape, which dominate the scenery, which you can see from miles away, which force your attention, which capture you. And these things demand submission and compliance. And I wonder what you think they are. If we had to say, you know, in our culture, what do you think are the dominating cultural influences which demand our attention, which demand that we bow down and serve them? What would you say? Let's have some suggestions. Flags, that's interesting. You're a military man, aren't you? So flags are symbols of something, and they represent perhaps patriotism or, you know, the value of our country. But flags are the symbols of something. What about the ideas, the influences? What else are there?
Celebrity.
Celebrity culture, very good, yes. So we've got people who are famous, who we look to as perhaps role models and worship them. Anything else?
Shopping centres,
consumerism, yes, that's important, isn't it? What else? Sorry?
Speed cameras.
Are they a dominating influence for you? You obviously drive too fast. Any other ideas?
Income tax,
all right. So government and compliance, those sort of things. Okay, there's other things. There's things like secularism. Big things, big influences, which represent the features of our culture that demand that we comply. There's relativism. You know, everything doesn't really matter what you believe as long as you're not absolute about it. You know, there's absolutely no absolute truth, as they say. So we've got all of these things, consumerism we've mentioned, materialism, a whole lot of things which demand our attention, demand our submission. These are the strong cultural influences. And the question is, what are we going to do with those? My personal thought is that the gold might represent materialism, but it's just one amongst many. I did hear a great Bible teacher in Guildford many years ago saying that all the bad things in the world end in ism, you know, communism, Marxism, capitalism, and I thought, evangelism, baptism. Anyway. So the challenge for us is, what do we do with these strong cultural influences? How do we respond to them? And we've got some guidance in Romans chapter 12, verse 2. I'm sure you know it. It says, "Do not be conformed to this world. Instead, be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." And you probably know that the word conformed is about pressing into a mould to make it pop out exactly the same, like cookie cutters. Let's get everybody the same. We're all conforming to the world's cultural influences. And the word transformed, be transformed, is metamorphosis, turning from a grubby little thing that goes around on the ground into a beautiful butterfly which can move in three dimensions and be completely different. Don't just be a cookie cutter like everybody else, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Think differently. And we need to think differently in the face of the challenges of our cultural influences. Don't just do what everybody else does. Don't just be materialistic or be driven by consumerism, you know, the shopping centres or the celebrity culture or those other things. Think differently. Think the way that God thinks. And that's the challenge. And I think that's the challenge of the golden image, the thing which is there in front of us, which demands our attention. Here's a second question. Did you ever wonder where Daniel was? We've got now Daniel chapter 1, Daniel in chapter 2. And then in chapter 3, suddenly it's Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and he's not there. And yet he'd been one of these sort of great leaders. He was promoted alongside them to be one of the bosses, and they were all supposed to be there. Where was Daniel? Hiding in the toilet, do you think? Do you think he was, you know, he didn't want to be confronted with this challenge and so gone off somewhere? One idea is maybe he was just on holiday and, you know, he wasn't there. Anyway, he's not there in the chapter. What do we learn from that? Do we learn anything? In the rest of the book, Daniel is the hero. He's the one who leads everybody. You know, we've got Daniel and then Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. And as Steve said again at the beginning of his talk last week, he was super gifted. He was the one who could, you know, get the interpretation of the dreams, and he could act in the within the culture and, you know, sort of influence people and so on. But now, when his friends need him, here's this great big challenge, Daniel's nowhere to be seen. What do we learn from that in terms of the way that we should respond in the culture that we find ourselves in? There's no heroes in the kingdom. God wants every one of us, doesn't matter how ordinary we are, to have our own faith in our own God. We can't rely on some superhero to kind of rescue us. And we'll just follow the Pope, we'll just follow Nigel, we'll just do what Barry teaches us, and we'll be okay. What do we do if Barry's not here? You know, if we're on our own and we face the challenge, and we can't sort of run off and ask some hero of the faith. We've got to do our own, have our own faith and our own response. And I love these verses, 1 Corinthians 1, that says, you know, in the kingdom, there are not that many who are really clever or really rich or who have been born well. It's not none. There are some, but not many. Why is that? Because God has chosen the little things in order to confound the wise and to prove that actually all the glory belongs to him. So we're looking for faith for the ordinary person, for the Shadrachs, for the Meshachs, for the Abednegos, not for the great Super Daniel. And that encourages me just to be, you know, I'm just one of the lads. You know, I'm just going along behind people. I'm a friend to Daniel. I'm not the Daniel. I'm a friend of Daniel's. And yet I face the same challenge. And God's looking to me to respond. So what was the image? Where was Daniel? I think it's a much more important question, which troubles a lot of us. And it's this. Where was God? Where was God when all this was going on? When his people were challenged with death by burning if they weren't going to submit and worship this image. And, you know, he didn't stop this whole challenge happening. He didn't intervene and say, right, Nebuchadnezzar, if you do that, I'm going to zap you. There wasn't some great sort of lightning bolt that came and destroyed the image. There probably were people who were burned in the fiery furnace. But where was God when we needed him? And that's the challenge. They were sure, his people were certain that he could do something. The God who we serve is able to deliver us out of your hand, O King. But they weren't absolutely sure that he would. And I think a lot of us are in the same position. We know it's true about God. He can do anything. You know, omnipotent. He has all power. He can do anything that can be done. He's omniscient. He knows everything that can be known. You know, all of the omnis, that's what God is. He's fantastic. But he doesn't always seem to show up. He doesn't always seem to do the things we expect. Apart from doing the unexpected. You would think God would blow the fire out, wouldn't you? Or God would send some angels down to sort of hoik them out just before they got thrown in or something. But no, he didn't. He let them get tied up and thrown in. Now, we have the benefit of the end of the story. You know, we look through to the end of the chapter and we see, phew, it was all okay. But they didn't know that. They knew that God could, they didn't know if God would. And that's the challenge that we face. The message is actually that God did do something. What he did was he went in the furnace too. And there was someone in the flames with them. In the flames with them. Not pulling them out of the flames, but in the flames with them. That, to me, is really important. We can't tell God what to do. But he will always be with us. Even when we're going through the flames. Even in the trial and the torment and the difficulty and the challenge. Even if it looks like it's all gone wrong, he is there with us. The whole idea of incarnation, you know, God coming down to be born amongst us, to share our struggles, to be identified with humanity. That is the incredible truth of the Christian faith. He came to us, and there's no need for us to be afraid of whatever the world can throw at us. He's going to be with us. One of my favourite talks I keep going back to this when I was about 17. I went to a youth camp down in Dorset, and an American preacher called Robert Frost preached on the word with for an hour and a half. Just the word with, and how with appears in the Bible, and how much it demonstrates the character and the heart of God to be with us. And that's a huge encouragement. Whatever we face, he's going to be with us. Okay, those are my three quick questions, but I want to draw one main lesson. And the main lesson comes from the heart of this story, from the main sort of two or three verses, which are in the middle, and it's verses 16 to 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If you do what you said you would do, our king who we serve is able to our God who we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Now, the whole message of Daniel, at least the first seven or eight chapters, is about faith. It's about different types of faith. And I'd like to just highlight three or four different types of faith that you find amongst Christians. Some people have what I call if-then faith. If you do this, God, I'll believe in you. If you give me a good job, if you keep me safe, if you look after my children, if you answer my prayers, then I'll believe in you. That's one kind of faith. I'm not sure it's a very good kind of faith, but it's one kind. We sometimes find the if-only faith. If only God would do something, then I believe in him. And the kind of anticipation or wishful thinking or hoping against hope and really wanting it, but we don't really expect it. And there's the yes but kind of faith. I know that's true, sort of. It's probably not going to work for me. There are probably reasons that I can't work out why the theory is okay, but the practice is not going to work out. I think what we need to know is the kind of faith that these guys had. What is the faith that took them into the fire and out the other side? How can we characterize what I'm calling fireproof faith? And it's these three words: but if not. It's unconditional faith in God. It doesn't matter what happens to me. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. It doesn't matter how bad it is. I'm going to stay faithful to God. God can, and he might. But even if he doesn't, I'm not going to bow down and worship your gods. I'm not going to give in and compromise with the cultural influences of today. I'm going to stay faithful to my calling. I'm going to be a child of God, even if he doesn't do anything to help me. And that's the kind of faith that we're looking for. That's the kind of challenge that we have from Daniel chapter 3, from these three ordinary guys who are faced with a really, really life-threatening challenge. What was their secret? How did they get that kind of amazing faith that said, I know God can, I don't know if God will, even if he doesn't, I'm still going to trust him? Well, some people think that this was their secret. They were great heroes of the faith, even though they were just Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But, you know, they had some fantastic super faith, which is what we all need to try and get. I don't think so. I think it was a little bit different. I don't think they had a great faith in God. I think they had faith in a great God. Isn't that clever? Do you like that? So that's what we're looking for. So I do it again. I love that. It's, it only took me about 30 seconds. If you think you know how to use PowerPoint, guys, this is... So it's not the level of faith you've got, it's the person you've got faith in. That's what matters. O King, we know that our God is able. That's the key. Not, we've got super faith in the God of Israel. No, they didn't. Maybe they didn't. Well, maybe they did. But they had faith in a great God. A God who could. A God who was able to deliver. A God who could save to the uttermost. That's the God we serve. And it doesn't matter how much faith or how little faith you've got. Faith like a mustard seed, Jesus said, is enough to move mountains. It's who you've got faith in. And if we believe that the God we have faith in is great, then that's enough. It's faith in a great God that we're looking for. So I think it's important that we apply this. And here's the application for us. You know, God can do anything. God can do absolutely anything. And in Isaiah 43, in the first two or three verses, there's a promise. You know, if you walk through the floods, I'll be with you. If you go through the flames, and here it is, you know, they won't hurt you because you're special to me. And so that's our promise. God is able. So when we face real difficulties and real challenges, God is able. What about long-term illness? God can heal. Do we all believe that God can heal? Of course we do. He can, but he doesn't always. No. That can't be right. What about, as Nigel said, you know, losing your job and not having enough money and being thrown out on the streets? No, that can't be right. Because God's going to look after you. God said he'll provide. God said I'm worth more than lots of sparrows and I shouldn't worry about what I eat, drink or wear. So what if it happens? What about if a dear, you know, if one of my loved ones suffers and dies? Where's God? How can that be right? If he can, but he won't. Because he could. You know, God could snap his fingers. All the sick people in the world could be healed right now. But he doesn't do it. Why do bad things happen when there's a good God? That's the challenge of this. And it's the but if not faith. That's the challenge for us. And, you know, we have some exemplars, some heroes and heroines of this kind of faith, who you and I know. My wife, Liz, who has, we've been married for 30 years, for 12 years she's had MS, maybe slightly more, and she is, knowing that God can heal, not healed. So what does she do with that? Do you get discouraged? Do you get into despair, depression, give up? Okay, that's it, you know, God's no good, I know the theory, doesn't work. So, that's it, I'm off. I'll try something else. Or can you find the but if not faith? And we've got, you know, we don't have to look very far around the room and you will see people who demonstrate this kind of faith. And that's the challenge for us. They're not Daniels. Liz isn't a Daniel. The other people that you know are not Daniels. They're not superheroes. They're ordinary people with ordinary faith in a great God. And we need to be the same. And Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble. Cheer up, I've overcome the world, John 16. 2 Timothy 3, though everyone who desires to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. I'm afraid it's a guarantee. 1 Peter 4:12, don't be surprised at the fiery trials that come upon you as if something strange was happening. You know, it happens, it's normal. That we're challenged, that we struggle, that things happen to us. We're not going to be delivered from adversity necessarily. We might be. God does do miracles. But we are going to be delivered in adversity. The fantastic thing is that God has always promised to be with us. He delights to be known as Emmanuel. And one day I'll talk about Emmanuel. But in the word Emmanuel, it does literally mean God with us. The emphasis is on the word with. In the Hebrew, the way the word is put together, it's actually the with us God. It's not God with us, it's the with us God. The emphasis is on the fact that he's identified with us. And Deuteronomy 31, he says, don't be in dread of the things that face you. Be of good cheer. Gosh, I'm going to read this because it's fantastic. He says, verse 6. Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear or be in dread of them. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Okay? Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear or be in dread. Some of the things we face are dreadful. Don't fear or be in dread, because it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. And 2 Corinthians, no, my grace is sufficient. My power is made perfect in weakness. He's going to be there. He's going to come through. And the important thing about faith that we learn from Hebrews chapter 11 is that it's the assurance of things you hope for, the conviction of things you don't see. If you see it, you don't need faith. You don't have to have faith that I'm standing here. You can see it. You know it's true. Okay? Sorry, but it's you might wish it wasn't, but it's true. Faith is for the things you can't see. I don't know if you've ever seen this little poem here. I believe in the sun, even when it is not shining. I believe in love, even when I do not feel it. And I believe in God, even when he is silent. You might have heard that. It was found scratched on a cellar, underground cellar in Cologne, in about 1948. And they think it was left there by some Jews who were hiding from the Nazis. You know, even in that, somebody said, if God is silent, I'm still going to believe in him. Very challenging. Okay, so three things I'd like us to remember from Daniel chapter 3. We do live in a culture which is not conducive, which is not friendly, which is not going to help us to be Christians. There are some nice things about the culture, but there are some things which are not so good. And the pressure is there, conform or else. There are real difficulties if we don't conform to consumerism, to materialism, to secularism, to relativism, all those bad isms. And the message of the Bible is don't. Don't conform, but be transformed. There is opposition. There are things that will intimidate us. In this country, we don't face so much as people, as Christians in other countries, who maybe are in real physical danger. But there is intimidation. There's no need to be afraid, because life can be difficult, but God has promised to always be with us. Promised always to be with us. That's important. I have got 2 minutes to talk about home security. Let me just very quickly talk about this. I won't spend long on it, but it's important. I thought I'd worry you first of all, because while we're here at church, somebody could be... No, let's not think about that. But, you have to think about these things, and maybe you might want to invest in a safe. So you have to think, if you're going to invest in a safe for your valuables, what kind of safe do you want? And we've just bought a safe at home for some of my company documents, commercially sensitive and so on. And we had to decide, do we want a big one, a small one, how much threat do we think we're under, and how much stuff have we got to hide away? I can tell you the answer to what we actually got, because when the DHL lady delivery person arrived, she carried it upstairs for me. So we didn't have one of these bomb-proof vaults, but we did have something that would keep something safe for a little while. And it is a question that some people face, do we need this kind of protection? And if we do need that kind of protection, how much of it do you need? And one of the features of these different types of safe is what they call their fire rating, how long they will last if they're in a fire. And you have to think about how long you need to keep a thing safe for. All right, well, what's that really got to do with Daniel chapter 3? I think there are two key questions that we find ourselves asking. How much faith have you got, and how much faith do you need? How big is your safe? Is it big enough? Will it last? Will it keep safe the things that you want to keep protected? Or is it going to break down in the challenge that you face? How much faith have you got? Have you got little mustard seed? Have you got super faith? Do you know what? I think the answer to both those questions is you don't know. You don't know how much faith you've got until it's tested. And you don't know how much faith you need until you get there, until you face the time of testing. And I think that's both worrying and encouraging. Because we need to trust God, not in terms of what he does, not in terms of the results that we see, but because of who he is. Who he is, not what he does or doesn't do. The basis of our faith is a great God, not the level of faith that we have. And I want to just end with a very quick story. I don't know how many people know Corrie ten Boom. Many people, everybody heard of Corrie ten Boom? She's a kind of hero, heroine, of the Second World War. She's a Dutch lady, and her family, when she was just a teenage girl, her family protected and hid Jewish people in their home. And when the Gestapo came around looking, they hid them. And she and her sister ended up going to a concentration camp because of it. And she is a great, fantastic lady. She's died now. I actually met her in 1972. And I've got here just an extract from a letter which I think that she wrote, which I think explains some of the things we're looking for. I know people, actually I know somebody very well, who's a very strong Christian, who is desperately worried about persecution. When it all goes wrong, when you get the great tribulation, if we're still here, what happens if I get arrested, and I get tortured, and I get sent to a concentration camp, and they threaten me, if you don't give up your faith, you know, what would you do if the soldiers came through the door, stood us all up at gunpoint, and said, recant or be shot? I don't know. She's really worried. She has nightmares. She won't watch any sort of films about Second World War or about persecution or any of those things. Desperately worries her. Here's Corrie ten Boom's story. When I was a little girl, I went to my father and said, Daddy, I'm afraid that I will never be strong enough to be a martyr for Jesus. Tell me, said Daddy, when you take a train trip to Amsterdam to see your granny, when do I give you the ticket? 3 weeks before? No, Daddy, you give me the ticket just before I get on the train. That's right, said my father. And so it is with God's strength. Our Father in heaven knows when you will need the strength to be a martyr for Jesus. He will supply all you need just in time. And I think that's a fantastic story of but if not faith. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about what you might face and how you might respond. Develop your relationship with God for now, and that will be enough. If you have faith in a great God, it will take you through absolutely anything. Let's just pray together. Father, we are so grateful that success doesn't depend on us or how much faith we can muster. Success depends on you. And if we've got faith in you, that's enough. And that's based on who you are: wonderful, trustworthy, reliable, loving, kind, good, merciful, faithful, just. That's why we have faith in you, because you're so wonderful. We pray that you help us to develop that faith, to live in that faith, and to be as countercultural as you want us to be, to face all of the challenges in that faith. In Jesus' name, amen.